books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, a chat with friend of the show, Josie Lloyd, our new cosy crime thriller, Miss Beaton's Murder Agency. And if you're a fan of the book she wrote with her husband, Emlyn Rees, we have some good news later on in today's show. All that, plus we'll find some new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library today on Read On. Josie Lloyd has been writing for 26 years and was last on Read On talking about Life Saving for Beginners, and before that, the Cancer Ladies Running Club. Her first seven books were written with her writing partner and then husband, Emlyn Rees, and stay tuned for an exclusive about that writing partnership coming up later on in today's show. But the book we're going to primarily talk about came out yesterday, if you're listening to this on the day it was released. Miss Beaton's Murder Agency is a gripping new cosy crime mystery. And as you'll hear during the interview, when I talked to Josie, the audio version hadn't been recorded yet. But hopefully future me is going to put in a clip as narrated by Emily Pennant May.
Alice Beaton shut the hardback library book with a satisfied snap. Never trust a man with a dimple in his chin. The kettle trilled like an old-fashioned police whistle. Alice walked across the small kitchen to turn off the gas, releasing the cap so that it gasped, the boiling water inside fizzing. Agatha barked once in reply, her bright brown eyes staring up at Alice, who now took a china cup and two saucers from the cupboard, moving the remaining crockery a fraction to retain their pleasingly neat stacks. With a silver spoon, she measured out the precise amount of Earl Grey tea leaves from the caddy into the teapot before filling it up from the kettle and placing a knitted cosy on top. As a self-confessed addict of crime fiction, Alice loved the twisty plots, red herrings and scattered clues that invariably resulted in her outsmarting most fictional detectives, with the exception of Miss Marple, of course. She had a prized set of all 80 Agatha Christies, after whom she'd named her dog, but she'd run out of space for any more books.
You've been on the show twice, first with Red Sail and the Cancelled Ladies Running Club, then with me and Life Saving for Beginners, and I believe that chat with Red inspired a scene in Life Saving for Beginners.
It certainly did, because he was a great swimmer, well, still is a great swimmer, and goes to the Hampstead Pond, and I was talking to him about it. I mean, I do have a sign in my kitchen, Robert, that says, "Careful or you'll end up in my novel," which actually does actually happen. So I was talking to Red and I was like, I'm putting you in a scene. So I actually put in at the end scene where one of my characters meets this guy at the Hampstead Pond. It was all inspired by Red and him swimming there. So yeah, it was really great. And he was really helpful actually with the details of it and what it felt like to kind of go in the water there.
Have you been in the sea this morning?
I certainly have. In fact, I'm glad this is not a visual thing, because I'm really pink. I've just been to the sauna. We have a sauna down on the seafront in Brighton. And I went with a gang of people this morning for a sauna. And then we swam in the sea in the rain. And it was absolutely glorious. I mean, it's belting it down here in Brighton currently. But it was beautiful swimming in the sea in the rain. And all the pier was really misty. And it was lovely. So yes, I have just been in the sea.
Now, you're swapping the Brighton beaches for a rather shabby block in Kensington. Tell us about Miss Beaton's Murder Agency.
Well, crime, as we know, is a broad church, Robert, and I would describe this as the cake stand in the hall. I mean, it is cosy crime, but I've always been intrigued by Mrs. Beaton, she of the very famous Book of Household Management, which came out in the Victorian era. And my granny had a copy of it, and it's so thick that I used to stand on it as a step when I was a tiny child. And then when I was clearing out my parents' house recently, I found the big copy of Mrs. Beaton's book. And I kind of thought, well, it'd be really fun to use this heritage. Also, because I really love recipes in books, because ever since I read Nora Ephron's Heartburn, I loved the idea of having recipes in books. So this is the kind of what went into it. Anyway, I came up with Miss Beaton's Murder Agency featuring Alice Beaton, who is a fictionally distant relative of the very famous Mrs. Beaton. And she runs the Good Household Management Agency in London. And she places elite staff for the uber rich. So she places nannies and chauffeurs and butlers and all these kind of things. She runs it with her best friend, Jinx, who is a lapsed it girl from the 90s with a wardrobe full of clothes and, you know, knows everybody. And this wonderful new girl, Enya, comes in. She's a new hire. And at the same time, Miss Beaton receives a call from Camille Messon, who's very posh and French, and says that her housekeeper has suddenly left. She's in a bind. Could Miss Beaton send someone? And it seems serendipitous and wonderful. And off she sends Enya to work in the Messons. And off she goes for Christmas. But then on New Year's Eve, she gets the call that Enya has been found murdered in the study of the Messons' household at their New Year's Eve party. And now Miss Beaton has to go in and find out why.
Alice's basement flat was never at its best early in the day, only brightening up when the sun was above the buildings opposite. Pulling up the Roman blind above the sink and peering up through the barred windows to street level, she noticed the weak, grey shimmer of the December sky. But the beast from the east that was predicted had yet to arrive. It really didn't look like it was going to snow, but you could never be too sure. Nevertheless, it was definitely a day for a thermal vest. On the table, trumpets of orange amaryllis that one of her grateful clients had sent filled the kitchen with a cheery dash of exotic colour. But despite everything being just right in her flat, it was hard to ignore the loud neighbours upstairs. She winced as that dratted son of theirs bounced a ball across her ceiling. She flicked on the radio, which was set permanently to Classic FM, and turned up the blast of Vivaldi as a riposte. Agatha barked again and tipped her head to one side. "I'm doing it," Alice said. "Be patient."
It was a really fun concept to write the book. So I've used Miss Beaton. She's quite a kind of quirky character, but I grew up on all those kind of women like Murder, She Wrote, Miss Marple, all this kind of thing. And I really hankered to write a midlife crime woman she's not forensic, she's got nothing to do with crime, but she's just got a bit of an ordered mind. And I kind of thought that was my way in, to make her somebody much more akin to me than somebody like a detective or something like that.
And it's set, well, it's got a contemporary setting, but it feels quite retro as well.
Yeah, I wanted to go for that kind of, you know, that lovely feeling of like films like Paddington or that kind of thing, where you have it's contemporary, but it's got all the best of London. And I love London. And when I was a very small child, we used to go to London to see my grandmother who lived there. And we lived in Essex. That's where I grew up. And we used to drive to London. And it was very exciting because we would drive through the streets of the kind of East End of London. And you would see St. Paul's and the Tower of London and all of the big sites. And I was always enamoured with London. And my grandmother used to take me to find Wombles on Wimbledon Common. That was when I was really tiny. But I used to write diaries on the way to see her, and she was the one that used to read them and laugh, not for the right reasons, I might add. I always kind of thought, well, I can entertain somebody through writing, and that was why I always wanted to become a writer. But I really wanted to use London in the best bits of London, the nice bits of London, and put all those kind of iconic buildings in that I love so much, but to have somebody sort of living and breathing it and being there. So yes, it is contemporary and it is set now, but I don't really, it's not kind of reliant on loads of technology, and it's got a cast of characters that kind of are fairly timeless. And yeah, she's got quite a retro vibe. And of course, it's all interdispersed with these original recipes from Mrs. Beaton's book. So, you know, recipes for her Christmas cake and the Christmas bunch. But I've also put recipes in that I love that are kind of cozy recipes for winter. So things like tiffin and, you know, nice soups and things like that. So it's quite fun.
It has got quite a wintry feel to the book. Can you describe the cover for us?
Yes, it's beautiful, the cover, actually. It's got a house, it's red, it's snowing, and it's a house, and it's a bit like It's kind of got a murdery vibe. You could see there's a thief or a robber in shadow in one of the top windows, and then somebody misbeaten is in another top window of the house, kind of looking. And by the front door is Agatha, and Agatha really is the star of the book. She is a Jack Russell Corgi Cross, a Kojak, I've named her. And she was found by Alice near the bins by Buckingham Palace. So she kind of has always entertained the thought that Agatha was related to the royal corgis. And of course, she is named after Agatha Christie, as Miss Beaton has all of the Agatha Christies. She has all 90 of them in her house. They're her prized possessions because she loves reading, and she loves reading crime books and working things out. So Agatha is named after Agatha Christie, and she is the star of the show. And on the cover of the book, Agatha is there with a rubber glove in her mouth going into the house. So it's very Christmassy, and it's very London, and it's got a nice cozy feel to it. I mean, it's got, obviously, it's crime, it's got dark elements in it, and there's quite a lot of jeopardy in it, but it's got this lovely vibe to it.
No spoilers, but is there a trigger warning for dog lovers?
No, don't worry. Don't well, yeah, to be fair, there is some jeopardy involving Agatha, but I can't give the plot away.
Yes,
But yes,
that's.
she's quite a star in it, though. And it's quite interesting, the marketing that's now sort of starting to happen because the book's about to come out, and the marketing team at the publishers have fallen in love with Agatha and have made her kind of completely integral to the kind of point of sale and everything that's going on in the shop. So it's really fun.
Now, this is one of these interviews that we're recording it long before it will be broadcast. The sun's shining, the trees are still green. By the time you listen to this, it'll be well into autumn. So you have just cast the audio version. Even though we heard a clip of it at the start of this interview, at the time of recording, we've just cast Emily Pennant-Ree. How did you end up with that narrator?
Well, there were several that were offered, and it's oh, Robert, it's the weirdest thing as an author to be presented with the voices of actors, because you are sent clips of other things that they've done on Audible or in any kind of audio world. And a lot of the really fantastic audio artists that we have working are so versatile. They've done everything. They've done kind of non-fiction, they've done fiction and crime and all sorts of things, and comedy. And so you get a kind of real kind of smorgasbord of what a voice can do, and then you're trying to pin it onto in your mind onto your character. And of course, when you write your own book, your characters have their own voices in your head, and it's so weird then hearing somebody else's voice, because you're like, oh, is that voice hers or not? And so it's a tricky one, and it's a kind of inexact science. You can't really tell, because at that point when you're casting, they're not actually reading your words. They're not giving you a sample of your book. You're listening to a sample of somebody else's book. And then so it's just really about the tone of somebody's voice. And I felt that she had the right tone, because Alice is quite, she's quite prim and proper. And like the kind of great Mrs. Beaton, the Miss Beaton, Alice, is kind of prim and proper and believes that if a job's worth doing, it's worth doing well. And she's kind of quite fastidious, and she's set in her ways, and she's single, she's in her mid-50s, and she kind of likes things done properly, and she doesn't like people being rude, and she likes decorum and manners, and she's a stickler for things. So she has that kind of personality, although she does have quite a soft side as well. So it's about getting that tone. But of course, you don't want somebody really I didn't want somebody really posh or really fuddy-duddy, because it has to be relatable. So I as an author, I find it incredibly difficult, but I listened to Emily's voice and I thought, yeah, actually she would be great for the job. So she's doing it. So hopefully by the time your listeners will be listening to this, it will be out, and they will be able to listen in to me at the end, because I'm going to go in and do an interview with her at the end of the recording, which will be very exciting. Because I love that when you get authors actually talking at the end of the recording. I've just listened to Elif Shafak's beautiful recording of There Are Rivers in the Sky. And it was lovely hearing her at the end doing her author's note.
You're quite a fan of Elif Shafak. I remember you
Yeah.
picked the Island of Missing Trees as one of your
Oh,
book
did I?
recommendations
Oh,
last time, yeah.
that's funny, because that was probably the last time. I am a fan of lots of other people, but yeah, I just
Now
happened to listen to that one.
it's in audio though, it's accessible to people for whatever reason don't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Yes. And I actually think that it's very important as well now that writers are. I think years ago, audio, we always used to record for the libraries, my books that I did with Emlyn, and we were always sort of very excited, but I'm so pleased that the audio world has completely taken off now and is bringing so many more readers to fiction because they're able to listen and get really involved and absorbed in it. And I think it's making authors write in a different way because you're aware when you're writing that this is going to be spoken, this is going to be spoken. And actually, I've just finished another book that I'm writing with Emlyn, my husband, because we used to write together and we've just written another book together. And we kind of had to read it out. And it's funny because when you write it, you're writing it as a prose, but then when you read it, you realize, oh, well, hang on, that needs to be three sentences, not one. You know, you start to realize that you have to be a bit more amenable to how it's going to sound rather than how it's just going to read. So there's minute differences, but they do make quite a difference.
I think I mentioned this to you before, but for new listeners, I recorded half of Come Together. I think I recorded the male half of it.
Brilliant, did you?
For the RNIB version, it's read by David
Oh,
Thorpe.
fabulous.
But it was one of these cases where I had to dig out a copy of the book and read the female version so I knew what was happening. Yeah. And we'll have more from Josie Lloyd later on in today's show, but now let's take a trip to the RNIB Library to find some brand new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Bloomsbury have given us a piece of biographical fiction. The Paris Muse is by Louise Trigar.
I was born Henriette Theodora Markovitch. I grew up in a colonial-style villa in Buenos Aires. Whitewashed walls, parquet floors, heavy mahogany furniture, everything flooded with sunlight. One of my earliest memories, I must have been about seven, was of lying in bed, looking at the white net curtains over my bedroom door, stirring in the breeze. Behind the curtains, windows were set in the door so at any time my parents could look in to see what I was doing. At night they could hear my even breathing and fall asleep in peace. They were in their 30s when I was born. They had lost hope of ever having a child, and it made them overprotective. On the other side of the door, I could just make out the shape of my parents' bed. I don't think it ever occurred to them that I might be watching them as they watched over me. But I could hardly help it. They were arguing again. Maman's voice was thin with distress. I can't stand living in Buenos Aires. It's so primitive. There's dirt and dust everywhere. Rough men staring at me every time I step out of the house, jabbering in Spanish. Such a crude, dirty language.
Paris, 1936. When Dora Maar, a talented French photographer, painter and poet, is introduced to Pablo Picasso, she's mesmerised by his dark and intense stare. Drawn to his volcanic creativity, it isn't long before she embarks on a passionate relationship with the Spanish artist that sometimes includes sadism and masochism and ultimately pushes her to the edge. The Paris Muse is a fictionalised retelling of this disturbing love story as we follow Dora on her journey of self-discovery and expression. Set in Paris in the French Riviera, where Dora and Pablo spent their holidays with their glamorous artist friends, it provides a fascinating insight into how Picasso was a genius who sidestepped the rules in his human relationships, as he did in his art. Much to Dora's torment, he refused to divorce his wife and conducted affairs with Dora's friends. The Spanish Civil War made him depressed and violent, as the encroaching darkness suffocates their relationship. A darkness that escalates once the Second World War begins and the Nazis invade the country. Dora has a nervous breakdown and is hospitalised. Atmospheric, intense and moving, The Paris Muse is an astonishing read that ensures that this talented, often overlooked woman who gave her life to Picasso is no longer a footnote.
The only reason Maman had agreed to leave Paris was my father's job as an architect and the promise it would make them rich. You'll have to stand it till we can afford to go back to France. Papito's voice was soft but threatening. I stiffened, sensing how badly he wanted to yell at her, but knowing he couldn't because of me. My father was a big, handsome man with dark eyes and thick, dark brown hair, but he had a temper. He was speaking to Maman in her language, French, which we spoke at home, but I also understood his language, Croatian. To me, it sounded gentle and affectionate. He called me Tatina Curica, Daddy's girl, and Moja Slatka Dorita, my sweet little Dora. I always felt torn between my parents, between Maman's French and Papito's Croatian. And now there was a new language, Spanish, that I was trying to learn, but that Maman insisted was dirty. I felt like I was made up of old and new, clean and grubby parts. Theodora, Dora, Dorita.
The Paris Muse by Louisa Traeger is read by Amy Noble and runs for 9 hours and 50 minutes.
Penguin Random House have given us a new look at World War II. The Strategists is by Phillips Payson O'Brien.
On the 29th of October 1941, as Adolf Hitler picked at his ostentatiously simple vegetarian dinner and sipped his favourite fizzy mineral water, his mind raced. He could taste victory, the greatest triumph in military history. German troops had just captured almost 750,000 Soviet soldiers around the city of Kyiv, the last of a series of smashing defeats inflicted on Joseph Stalin's Red Army since the launch of Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union on the 22nd of June. From his Spartan, bug-ridden headquarters in East Prussia, codenamed Wolfschanze, Wolf's Lair, Hitler saw the unfolding campaign as confirmation of his own genius. Only his daring and strategic vision, he believed, could have brought his nation to this precipice of victory. Soon Germany would have a massive new empire in which to settle genetically healthy Germans while wiping out anyone or anything that stood in Hitler's way.
Churchill, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Roosevelt. Five of the most impactful leaders of World War II, each with their own individualistic and idiosyncratic approach to warfare. But if we want to understand their military strategy, we must first understand the strategist. Professor Phillips Payson O'Brien shows us how the views these five leaders forged in World War I are crucial to understanding how they fought World War II. For example, Churchill's experiences facing the German army in France in 1916 made him unwilling to send masses of British soldiers back there in the 1940s, while Hitler's mistakes on the Eastern Front were influenced by his reluctance to accept that conditions had changed since his own time fighting. The implications of the power of leaders remain with us to this day. To truly understand what is happening in Ukraine, for example, requires us to know what has influenced the leaders involved.
With ideas cascading in his head, Hitler had taken to giving long monologues to hand-picked military officers and political cronies who sat obediently at his dinner table. On this night, Hitler's guests included Günther von Kluge, a Prussian-born field marshal whose military service had commenced in 1901. Von Kluge was commander of the 4th German Army, one of the most powerful forces attacking the Soviet Union. As Hitler well knew, even as the German army as a whole was winning battles, some senior commanders were worried that these victories were drawing their troops ever further into the unconquerable vastness of Russia, threatening to buckle the entire German logistical system. Major problems were appearing for the Germans on both rail and road. Since the days of Tsarist Russia, railway lines in the Soviet Union had been built with a wider gauge than those of the rest of Europe. Knowing this, the Germans had hoped to capture Soviet railcars to keep supplies moving forward as quickly as possible. Soviet forces, however, withdrew almost all their locomotives as the Germans advanced and destroyed as much railway infrastructure as they could. Thus, the Germans were left with the laborious and time-consuming task of rebuilding the Soviet railway system to run their own trains and keep up their advance. It slowed their pace considerably.
The Strategists by Phillips O'Brien is read by Mikhail Sain and runs for 17 hours and 16 minutes.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now on Read On, a return to our chat with Josie Lloyd. Her first few books from 25 or 26 years ago were written with her writing partner and then husband, Emmeline Rees. And well, here's some good news that you heard here first.
Well, we've just done another one, which is very exciting. In fact, you're the first person to know, Robert. Yeah, we have, because we used to write, Emmeline and I got together writing Come Together, which, I mean, is such a blast from the past. It's sort of set in the 90s, and it was about our 20-something lifestyle then. But we're just about to celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary, and so we thought we'd write another book, which is a his-her book. So we've just submitted that one to the agents, the edit of it to the agents. So we're waiting for that. This is a horrible moment, Robert, when you kind of like, you know somebody's reading and your ears are burning and you go, oh, do they like it? Will they sell it? Oh, it's so exciting. So Emmeline and I are pacing around going, is the phone going to ring? Have you seen an email? So that sort of thing. But yeah, it's really been wonderful to write with him again, because he really helped me with Miss Beaton, actually, because it's a different thing writing crime to anything that I've done before, because of all my books, you know, all my Joanna Rees books, a lot of them have always involved kind of crime elements or jeopardy elements. But when you actually sit down to write a cozy crime and an actual contained crime, it's a different process that I didn't realise, because I did a plot document as I would normally have done. And then I was like, no, that doesn't quite work. And I realised that you kind of have to start from the centre inwards. You have to kind of nail down the centre of the onion first. So you have to work out who's been murdered, by whom and why. Those are the things that you have to start off with, and then you put all the layers on top of it. So then you put the layers of the onion around it, which is a different kind of way of how I've worked before. Usually my plots sort of evolve and kind of come from the characters, and I'm kind of working on an arc, and this was kind of a much more contained thing. So it was a different, very interesting and different writing process. And Emmeline, bless him, who's edited quite a lot of crime himself, he did rescue me from a few plot cul-de-sacs, because you have to be really logical. And also because I'm so aware that, you know, crime readers and listeners are incredibly discerning, and they will spot holes in it if there are any.
Now, going back to the book you wrote with Emmeline, I know these things can change, but does it have a title?
It's called You and Me and You and Me and You and Me. And it's a multiverse rom-com. So it's about a couple who are in their 50s in Brighton, who are very much like us, but they're very disillusioned, and they're kind of bogged down by all the mistakes, and they're kind of not in a great place. And they discover a time portal in their shed, which means that they can go back to certain moments of the past and change things, which of course goes really swimmingly well and then really disastrously wrong. So it's a comedy and really, really funny. So we've loved writing it, but it's been quite challenging, I can tell you. But anyway, I'll let you know what happens with that one.
You heard it here first.
Heard it here first, yeah, you did.
She poured the tea from the dainty spout into one of the saucers, topped it up with cold milk from the jug, and placed it on the floor where Agatha lapped at it. But just as she was pouring her own cup, the ancient egg-shaped timer pinged. Alice jumped and put the teapot down. It got her every time. She thought, as she often did, of how this small object brought her back to sitting on the bowed wooden counter in the kitchen of Hawthorne Hall, as Mrs. Doulton taught her chapter and verse about running a kitchen and a household. Her memories had the same quality as those Kodak prints of the time, faded and most definitely of a different era. But Mrs. Doulton remained more like a feeling, the person who felt like home. Even now, 5 years after she'd passed on, Alice missed her old mentor, and the person who'd been more like a mother than anyone else, with an ache that she knew would never subside. She slid on her oven gloves and peered through the clear glass door. But even without the timer, she could tell from the delicious aroma that the biscuits were done to perfection. They were made to the precise recipe of her Victorian ancestor, the very famous Isabella Beaton, she of the Book of Household Management fame. Alice liked to live by the standards of her long-lost relative. Neatness, orderliness, punctuality, and hard work. And of course, the satisfaction and comfort of home baking.
One section of books you wrote with Emmeline that we've never actually talked about on the show are your parodies. Tell us about going on a bar hunt.
Oh, well, that was kind of came up in a conversation in the pub. And we have three girls who are now sadly grown up. I mean, not that it's sad that they've grown up. I love them being young women, but I love them being babies too. But anyway, we always have a million books in our house and we've always read to our girls. We always used to read We're Going on a Bear Hunt, and they always used to love all the voices and we can't go over it, can't go under it, gotta go through it. But of course, as young parents, we kind of like subverting it. So we were in the pub, we said, we should call it We're Going on a Bar Hunt. And how about we have a couple like us who are trying to get out of parenting and go out for a night, and they have to drink through all the bars. So it was just a really funny idea. And then our friend James Gerbert kind of loved the idea too. And then it took off, and we found a wonderful illustrator, Gillian Johnson, who managed to really parody the kind of original style of the Bear Hunt book, and it went from there. So yes, and it's hilarious how much it turns up. You know, lots of people have it in their downstairs loo, I notice. And then there was then we did another one called The Very Hungover Caterpillar, which was obviously about the very hungover caterpillar, and which was in the light of the hall, a fully dressed man lays on the sofa. The light comes out. And up wakes a very hungover caterpillar. And it's about this guy who eats, you know, in the hungry caterpillar, the hungry caterpillar eats all these things and kind of makes he eats one leaf and two this and two that. In mine, he has one full fat Coke, two paracetamol, but he was still hungover. So then he has two rashers of bacon, some slices of toast, and three cups of tea, but he was still hungover. So it goes on and on and on through the day of the guy trying to eat away his hangover, which was very funny. And then we did The Teenager Who Came to Tea, very much based on The Tiger Who Came to Tea, about a teenager who comes and just drinks, you know, comes into the house and just drinks and eats everything like the tiger does. So that was really fun. So yeah, they were hilarious and very, very good fun to write.
No, there aren't any actual official audio versions of these books, but there are plenty of people who have read them for you on YouTube. Just go to YouTube and search for The Very Hungover Caterpillar.
Yeah, there's lots on YouTube. You can find them. There's some really funny recordings of them, actually. Lots of people have done them.
This is coming out your book, The Cancelled Ladies Running Club. Are you still a patron of Lobular Breast Cancer UK?
Yes, I certainly am. Yeah, and I'm doing a lot of work with them to do with wellness days for people going through a lobular breast diagnosis, because there are two types of breast cancer. There's lobular and ductal. Most people get ductal breast cancer, but lobules are the bits between the ducts in your breast, and it can present in a different way. And so there's just a lot of work to do about educating women that it's not just a lump that they're looking for. They're looking for strange bits of breast tissue that don't feel quite right, and to go and get those checked out, because it grows in a different way to ductal cancer, so it doesn't really ever present as a lump. So Yes, I'm doing lots of work with the charity, and actually that's been really great to try and work out how we can change the NICE patient guidelines is what we're trying to do, to try and treatment guidelines so that we could get treatment that's specifically for lobular breast cancer.
Now, the teenager in me loves walking our mammaries.
Oh, yeah. With the charity, we did a big initiative called Walking Our Mammaries, which is all about walking up and down hills to raise money for the charity. And of course, there's lots of hills in the UK that are named after breasts. So the Moors in Scotland, which is what we walked, were named after breasts. Manchester was named after, is built on a breast-shaped hill, would you believe? So there are lots of places in the country where you can walk up a hill that looks like a breast. So we did that. Although I have to say, the last one we did, we were in absolutely torrential rain. It was quite something. That was up in Derbyshire. But yeah, it's been really fun doing lots of walking for the charity and doing lots of speaking on their behalf. I do quite a lot of wellness days. And if anybody out there who has had a lobular diagnosis, please do go and check out lobularbreastcancer.org.uk, because we do quite a lot of events around the country and online events to kind of for wellbeing days and to get people connected to stop them feeling so isolated.
Hopefully by the time you listen to this, Miss Beaton's murder agency will have just been released. And Josie, thank you so much.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. As always, Robert, thank you ever so much for having me on the show.
And Josie will be back with the books of her life.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. Enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy A Book for the Younger Listener or Young at Heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now more from RNIB Libraries.
For those interested in politics and history, we have Twilight of Democracy, The Failure of Politics and the Parting of Friends by Anne Applebaum, which was given to us by Penguin Random House.
Monarchy, tyranny, oligarchy, democracy. All of these ways of organizing societies were familiar to Plato and Aristotle more than 2,000 years ago. But the illiberal one-party state, now found all over the world, think of China, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, was first developed by Lenin in Russia starting in 1917. In the political science textbooks of the future, the Soviet Union's founder will surely be remembered not just for his Marxist beliefs, but as the inventor of this enduring form of political organization. It is the model that many of the world's autocrats use today. Unlike Marxism, the illiberal one-party state is not a philosophy. It is a mechanism for holding power, and it functions happily alongside many ideologies. It works because it clearly defines who gets to be the elite: the political elite, the cultural elite, the financial elite.
In the years just before and after the fall of the Berlin Wall, conservative politicians and intellectuals across Europe and America celebrated a great achievement, felt a common purpose, and very often forged personal friendships. The euphoria quickly evaporated, the common purpose and centre ground gradually disappeared, and eventually, as this book compellingly relates, the relationships soured too. Anne Applebaum traces a familiar history in an unfamiliar way, looking at the trajectories of individuals caught up in the public events of the last three decades. If you are a journalist, an intellectual, a civic leader, how do you deal with the reemergence of authoritarian or nationalist ideas in your country?
In the monarchies of pre-revolutionary France and Russia, the right to rule was granted to the aristocracy, which defined itself by rigid codes of breeding and etiquette. In modern Western democracies, the right to rule is granted, at least in theory, by different forms of competition. Campaigning and voting, meritocratic tests that determine access to higher education and the civil service, free markets. Old-fashioned social hierarchies are usually part of the mix, but in modern Britain, America, France, and until recently Poland, most assumed that democratic competition is the most just and efficient way to distribute power. The most appealing and competent politicians should rule. The institutions of the state, the judiciary, the civil service, should be occupied by qualified people. The contests between them should take place on an even playing field to ensure a fair outcome. Lenin's one-party state was based on different values. It overthrew the aristocratic order, but it did not put a competitive model in its place. The Bolshevik one-party state was not merely undemocratic, it was also anti-competitive and anti-meritocratic. Places in universities, civil service jobs, and roles in government and industry did not go to the most industrious or the most capable. They went to the most loyal. Individuals advanced not because of talent or industry, but because they were willing to conform to the rules of the party. Though those rules were different at different times, they were consistent in certain ways. They usually excluded the former ruling elite and their children, as well as suspicious ethnic groups. They favored the children of the working class. Above all, they favored people who loudly professed belief in the party, who attended party meetings, who participated in public displays of enthusiasm. Unlike an ordinary oligarchy, the one-party state allows for upward mobility. True believers can advance, a prospect especially appealing to people whom the previous regime or society had not promoted.
Twilight of Democracy, The Failure of Politics and the Parting of Friends by Anne Applebaum is read by the author and runs for 5 hours and 16 minutes.
The Two Lives of Lewis and Louise by Julie Cohen was donated by Orion.
In this moment of birth, Lewis and Louise are the same person in two different lives. They are separated only by the gender announced by the doctor and a final E. Their genitals are different, but their faces are the same. And really, in most lights and most expressions, they look more like Irving than his great-great-grandfather. Although there's some Peggy in there, too, especially when they're asleep. When Peggy and her baby are asleep together, Lou with their head on their mother's naked breast, their peaceful closed eyes and relaxed mouths are identical.
Two people, two lives, one chance to see the same world differently. Lewis and Louise are the same person born in two different lives. One was born female and one male. They have the same best friends, the same red hair, the same dream of being a writer, the same excellent whistle. They both suffer one catastrophic night with life-changing consequences. 13 years later, they're both coming home. A tender, insightful, and timely novel about the things that bring us together and those which separate us.
Lewis and Louise aren't twins. Not like Mary's fraternal twins, Allie and Benny, whom we will know much better in time. Peggy and Irving Alder only ever have one child. Peggy, who fell pregnant so easily the first time, never carries another baby to term. Lewis and Louise at conception are one egg and one sperm. Except in this version of life, the sperm carries the X chromosome, and in that version, the sperm carries the Y. Sperm and egg meet and begin to divide and multiply. As a fetus, Lou's sex is at first indistinguishable. At 7 weeks gestation, their genitals begin to develop. Unseen inside Peggy's body in 1978, with an uncomplicated pregnancy, they could be any sex. They could be any gender. There are so many other things about them, equally unseen, that are also true. Eye color, hair color, the curve of their smile, myopia, a mole on their thigh, a propensity to hay fever, their future love for salty food and science fiction, the steady beat of their heart. But when Lou is born, their biological sex is the first thing that anyone sees, the first question anyone asks, the beginning of every single choice made about this person, even before they have the power to make choices for themselves. At this moment of birth, even before they've taken their first breath and cried their first cry, Lou Alder is the nexus of all their parents' dreams. But those dreams are different for son and for daughter.
The Two Lives of Louis and Louise by Julie Cohen is read by Patricia Rodriguez and runs for 10 hours and 41 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally on today's show, a return to Josie Lloyd for the books of her life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Yes, obviously. There were lots of books around. I mean, there's many more books around now for my children. I remember Enid Blyton, The Magic Faraway Tree, being the one that I kind of really probably first read on my own, under my own steam, and finding that kind of really fascinating. But my mum always used to read to us, and she used to read poetry quite a lot, and she used to read Robert Stevenson's Anthology of Childhood Verse, and I can remember all the poems from that. So actually I kind of got a real those kind of childhood poems about the lamplighter and all those kind of poems kind of really resonate with me and remind me most of my childhood.
The Lamplighter. My tea is nearly ready and the sun has left the sky. It's time to take the window to see Leary going by. For every night at tea time and before you take your seat, with lantern and with ladder, he comes posting up the street. Now, Tom would be a driver and Maria go to sea, and my papa's a banker and as rich as he can be. But I, when I am stronger and can choose what I'm to do, oh, Leary, I'll go round at night and light the lamps with you. For we are very lucky with a lamp before the door, and Leary stops to light it, as he lights so many more. And, oh, before you hurry by with ladder and with light, oh, Leary, see a little child and nod to him tonight. Good and Bad Children. Children, you are very little, and your bones are very brittle. If you would grow great and stately, you must try to walk sedately. You must still be bright and quiet and content with simple diet and remain through all bewildering, innocent and honest children. Happy hearts and happy faces, happy play in grassy places. That was how in ancient ages children grew to kings and sages. But the unkind and the unruly, and the sort who eat unduly, they must never hope for glory. Theirs is quite a different story. Cruel children, crying babies, all grow up as geese and gabies, hated as their age increases by their nephews and their nieces.
David Monteith reading a few verses from Robert Louis Stevenson's A Child's Garden of Verse, available in the RNIB Library. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Wow, I've mentioned this before on the show. I am not a great fan of rereading, to be honest, because I am so thirsty for books and I have a terrible book buying habit. I mean, honestly, it's awful. They're like sweets to me, books. I go into a bookshop and I'm like, oh, I want that one. Oh, no, I want that one. And I'm terrible because I'm forever, you know, collecting books that I don't know that I'm ever going to have the time to read. But I'm also, as soon as I've finished a great book, what I do is I hand it over immediately to whatever friend is around. And I press it onto them. You've got to read this book, which means that I've got shelves and shelves of books. But all of the really good ones I've given away. So that's a bit annoying. But if I was going to reread, and then also that I always go back to Daphne du Maurier. I love her books and I love the way she writes and I love the way that she builds tension. And I have actually read My Cousin Rachel two or three times. So I think it would be one of her books that I would go back to for sure.
Had I been another man, agile and quick, with a deft tongue and a shrewd head for business, the past year would have been no more than another 12 months come and gone. I should be settling down to a brisk, contented future, to marriage possibly, and to a young family. But I was none of these things, nor was Ambrose. We were dreamers, both of us, unpractical, reserved, full of great theories never put to test, and like all dreamers, asleep to the waking world. Disliking our fellow men, we craved affection, but shyness kept impulse dormant until a heart was touched. When that happened, the heavens opened, and we felt, the pair of us, that we had the whole wealth of the universe to give. We would have both survived had we been other men. Rachel would have come here just the same, spent a night or two and gone her way. Matters of business would have been discussed, some settlement arranged, and the will read formally with lawyers round a table, and I, summing up the position in a glance, would have given her an annuity for life and so been quit of her. It did not happen that way because I looked like Ambrose. It did not happen that way because I felt like Ambrose. When I went up to her room that first evening she arrived, and after knocking stood within the door, my head bent slightly because of the low lintel, and she got up from the chair where she'd been sitting by the window and looked up at me, I should have known then, from the glance of recognition in her eyes, that it was not I she saw, but Ambrose. Not Philip, but a phantom.
My Cousin Rachel by Daphne du Maurier is in the RNIB library as read by Jonathan Price.
And is there something you've read recently? Doesn't have to be contemporary, but it's a book you've read recently that you'd like to recommend.
So one of my summer reading books was Butter by Asako Yuzuki, a Japanese author who did a really unusual book. I love reading books that are of a completely different culture and something I really don't know about. And actually, she wrote this book about women in Japanese culture and this whole sense that they have to be not only really great in the domestic sphere, but also look really great and they have to have massive self-control. And it's a fabulous book about this young journalist who becomes enamoured with this prisoner, this woman who has been put away for allegedly murdering some men that she's kind of ingratiated herself with in order to get their money. And what's fascinating about this prisoner is that she really, really embraces her lifestyle of eating loads. And I think what really appealed to me about this book, so on the back of writing Miss Beaton, there was lots of really great descriptions of food in it. There's one wonderful bit where the prisoner makes our heroine go home. She says, well, you don't care about food, and so I'm not going to talk to you until you actually have discovered food and discovered butter. And there's a shortage of butter in Japan at this time, and she makes her go to a shop and buy a really expensive block of butter and then go home and cook perfect rice in a rice steamer and then put a slice of butter and soy sauce on this rice and then to eat it and come back and tell her how she felt. And actually, but the description of it was so mouth-watering, I was like, oh, I want rice and butter and soy sauce now. Because I am really impressionable when it comes to reading things like that. So yes, that was a really, really enjoyed. That was a great read.
By focusing solely on the question of whether the victim was wrong to permit or encourage the taking of the photographs, the revenge porn debate has swung way off course. So long as we keep up this culture of victim blaming, these kinds of cases will continue to occur. The speaker's black-suited forearms flung out haphazardly across the panelist's bench were unusually long. His greying cheeks were drawn, his dark hair was speckled with white, and his eyes, so googly that they seemed ready to drop out at any minute, were cushioned by unhealthy-looking black bags. He was hardly what you'd call a dreamboat. And yet, every time his fierce expression relaxed a little, every time his Adam's apple travelled up his long neck, Lika would find herself fixed on the sight of him. Here he was on a morning chat show, speaking about the case where an office worker from Hamamatsucho had been strangled to death after naked photographs of her were leaked online by her ex-boyfriend. "Oh, Shinoi's doing these kinds of programs now, is he?" came a voice from behind her. It was her colleague, Kitamura, 4 years her junior. I suppose that, despite that gangster face of his, he's got a sexy aura. For a man in his mid-40s, his opinions are pretty sympathetic to women, so he probably goes down well with housewives, and he's in good shape for his age. "You think?" said Lika, doing her best to look as disinterested as possible as she smiled and looked away from the screen, picking up the remote that lay on the old sofa.
Butter by Asako Yuzuki is available both commercially and in the RNIB Talking Books Library, as narrated by Hanako Footman. And once again, Josie, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thank you ever so much. I've loved being on your show, as always.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.